Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for July 8, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got two guests scheduled for tonight, neither of whom is here yet, so we'll be biting our nails until at least one of them arrives. The first is Lakshman Achuthan, who is the Managing Director and Director of Research at the Economic Cycle Research Institute, and he'll be talking about just what this business cycle is all about. He is the author, co-author of a book called Beating the Business Cycle, which was recently published by Currency Doubleday. And he will put some context on some of the indicators I've been talking to you about at the top of the show for the last several months. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined, God willing, by Norman Kelly, who is the author of the new book, The Head Negro in Charge Syndrome, The Dead End of Black Politics, which the cover tells us is a controversial critique of black politics and intellectual leadership in America, and that just recently published by Nation Books. And before we get to the not-yet-materialized guests, a look at some of the economic news. Or at least some of the numbers that have been coming out of the last week or so. First of all, the weekly Thursday release of jobless claims figures, that is, the tally of people who have lost their jobs and sign up for unemployment insurance benefits for last week. That number fell by a very dramatic 39,000 to 310,000, the lowest level in, I believe, 4 years. Now, this must be taken with some degree of salt or some portion of salt because the figures are seasonally adjusted, and some people are think that seasonal adjustment is a way that the government cooks the books to tell people what it wants to. But, in fact, seasonal adjustment is a very defensible procedure. The classic example of seasonal adjustment is what happens around Christmas. The retail sales skyrocket as people shop for Christmas. Retail hiring expands as stores hire people to handle the Christmas rush, and that is all reversed in January. So seasonal adjustment is compensating for things like that. So there may be some problems relating to the seasonal adjustment, but anyway, that is showing at least some sign of tightening in the labor market. Slower pace of layoffs, at least, not necessarily a more rapid pace of hiring, which, as was reported last Friday, was rather disappointing. After several months of very, very strong job gains, last Friday it was reported that only, 112,000 new jobs were added in the month, very well below expectations, and certainly not a collapse by any means, but also a disappointing number. But the ABC News Money Magazine weekly measure of consumer attitudes continued its remarkable ascent. It has risen now for three straight weeks, and is now at the highest it's been in 5 months. So it took a dip in April, May, into early June, and then has suddenly reversed itself, and it's now above its previous high. So it does seem that even though high gasoline prices and such have been weighing, and perhaps war news have been weighing down consumer attitudes, it may be that the improving job market is causing them to show a little more buoyancy. But then we're getting mixed messages out of the retail sector. If people are feeling more optimistic, you would think they would be buying more. But it was reported by both the International Council of Shopping Centers and Johnson Redbook, two private firms that do a lot of retail surveys, that department store sales, chain store sales, rather, in the month of June were rather disappointing. They were positive, but rather weak in comparison to both expectations and recent trends. Also reported July 1st, a week ago, that auto sales for the month of June were very disappointing. So it may be that that's reflecting that little fall off in confidence in May and early June, and we'll see a pickup in July. But on the other hand, it may be that the economy is hitting a soft spot, as some people are saying, but we have the expert here. We'll be talking to him in a moment about that. The Institute for Supply Management, which surveys purchasing managers, the people who buy things for corporations and who presumably are in close touch with the state of business at those corporations, That the service sector index was off a bit in June, falling from 65 to 59.9. But as is the case with these things, when the number is above 50, it indicates expansion. So we're seeing a slightly slower pace of expansion in the service sector, but still relatively healthy. And it also showed an increase in employment the fourth or fifth consecutive month. So that is showing an improving service sector. And also manufacturing, at least on some surveys, is looking better. The Manufacturers Alliance survey rose to 80 for the second quarter of 2004, a very strong number, I think a record in the series. So at least manufacturing executives are rather optimistic, strong expectations for the state of their business. But on the other hand, the government reports that factory orders in the month of May were off. And as the series would follow here rather closely, the non-defense capital goods, that is, things used to build things rather than destroy them, has now fallen substantially for two consecutive months. We should be seeing that rising if the economy were in a normal, healthy acceleration phase. So we'll hear what Lakshman Achuthan has to think about all that in just a moment. But before we get to him, let's just take this musical break, the only song I know of about the business cycle. Mm-hmm. And that was Stereolab's song, Ping Pong. And in case you couldn't understand the Euro accent, it's all right because historical pattern has shown how the economic cycle tends to revolve. In a round of decades, three stages stand out in a loop. A slump, a war, then back to square one and back for more. Bigger slump, bigger wars, and a smaller recovery. Huger slump and greater wars and a shallower recovery. That's not really about the business cycle, strictly speaking. It's more about the long wave contraria theory, which is a theory with a very small sample to test, but dearly held by some people in the economic world and also apparently in the world of arty Euro pop stars. Welcome to Behind the News, Lakshman Achuthan. And I stumble over your name every time. I'm getting better. I'm practicing.
I stumbled over it for years. I'm only now getting it down.
So you are the research director. What's your title exactly? Managing director and director of research at the Economic Cycle Research Institute and co-author with your colleague at the Economic Cycle Research Institute, Anner von Banerjee, of Beating the Business Cycle, a book recently published by Doubleday. Well, before I ask you for your point of view on the state of things at the present, just what is the business cycle, and why should our listeners, most of whom I think don't manage large portfolios, why should they care about it?
Well, because the business cycle, it's kind of it's the ebb and flow of the economy outside your window. Meaning, sometimes things are going good, and you see, you don't seem to be worried about your job. Maybe you're able to get a raise. If you own a house or something, the value might be going up, or if you have some investments, maybe they're going up instead of going down. This is all the kind of things that happen during the expansion phase of the business cycle. And what happens is, it's something that's unique to a market economy, a capitalist economy, is this business cycle. And what happens is, invariably, people start to underestimate risk and start to do, in various forms, riskier and riskier or more and more untenable things. And in each expansion, this takes a different shape. The story is a different shape. But it essentially becomes unsustainable. Extremes develop, and activity will begin a downturn in a very pervasive way. It's what we call a vicious downturn, which kind of feeds on itself, where either businesses pull back or consumers pull back first, and then the other one follows, and they start following each other in this vicious cycle, and the economy starts turning down. People start losing their jobs, investments start losing value, and everything seems pretty grim until it gets to a point where there's pent-up demand or it's accompanied by a lot of stimulus from policymakers more recently to kind of get things turned around and get things going in the virtuous way again, where people are feeling optimistic and spending money, and then people are hiring people, and we start this recovery part of the cycle. And basically, like the song was suggesting, it is a ping pong. It kind of goes up, it goes down. The one thing I'm pretty convinced of is if you are in a free market economy, you are going to have cycles. You're going to have upswings and downswings. We don't know exactly why the next downturn is going to occur each time. The circumstances could be a little bit different. We certainly don't know how long the expansion is going to be. They've been as short as a year. And in this country, we've seen them as long as 10 years. In other countries, we've seen them last a little bit longer than that. So you can see it's a broad definition. But basically, it's the ebb and flow of the economy. And it's important to individuals because, I mean, if you get fired or something like that, it's and you can't find that next job, nobody wants to hire. That could be because of where we are in the business cycle.
And although it's called a cycle, you can't set your watch by it.
No, absolutely not.
In the 50s, we had short expansions, 2-3 years,
mm-hmm.
relatively frequent and relatively long recessions. In the 60s, we had a very long expansion. In the 70s, we were back in the short mode again. And mm-hmm. then in the 80s, we had a very long expansion. The 90s again. And the recessions have gotten shorter in recent years.
Yeah, I think the best thing we could say, we're not completely sure why. We have some basic ideas why that we discuss in the book, but it seems over the last couple hundred years that we can say that recessions have gotten a little shorter and they've become a little milder in terms of things like GDP or employment or sales or income. And all of these numbers mean nothing to the individual. These are just numbers that economists play with. But in that sense, they've gotten a little bit milder.
Well, in the 19th century, they had colorful names for them. They were panics and depressions. But we haven't had one of those since, at least in the northern hemisphere, since the 1930s.
Right, and it doesn't mean it can't happen again, but there are hopefully certain types of stabilizers that are put in place. For example, the whole New Deal kind of stabilizes. It's a stabilizer for the economy. The idea of unemployment insurance, for example, is a stabilizer.
The second Bush administration is going to do its best to repeal that if they can. But this cycle has been extremely unusual in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
For example, it was led not by a really aggressive tightening by the Fed. There was no significant inflation threat,
yep.
And investment collapsed. But the consumer kept spending. There was very little in the way of a consumer recession.
Yep.
What happened? Has the cycle changed? Is this anomalous? Is the process not yet through? Are we going to see something funny in the next cycle?
Yeah, no, I think what if we step back from what's going on today and like step back a couple of years and look at what happened around the end of the millennium, what we see is the first what we would call business-led recession in the post-war period. That's why it seems so strange. We did have these prior to World War II. It was actually the Depression was a business-led recession at the end of the 20s. Incidentally, you know, the 1920s was also deemed a new era where we had figured out how to manage the economy and we would never have another downturn. And what happens is when people start thinking that way, they start to do really stupid things. Like they start to build tons and tons of capacity, assuming that demand could never turn down. For example, there's a lot of fiber optic cable out there, right? And we still haven't used it up.
95% of it's never going to be used.
It's never going to be used. But hey, it seemed like a good investment in the late 90s. And what happens is if a business goes and invests in its capacity like that and demand doesn't meet these kind of this fantasy expectation they have that is going to occur, then they can no longer make money. They become unprofitable, and they need to start pulling back on all their investment, including in people. And they start cutting people back. And that then starts a vicious cycle where you don't have all of the consumption that you otherwise would have had to give profits to companies. And that's the story, the fundamental story behind the last recession, the last business-led recession that we had. And it was quite unusual if you only looked at the post-war period. Of course, when you're looking at cycles, they don't happen all the time, so we have to look a lot longer than that. We have to look over centuries to see maybe 20 observations, right, of what a cycle looks like. And therefore, we had seen that this could happen. It didn't seem like it could never happen. It had happened, and it really shaped what this country is in some ways, the 20s and the 30s. And then what you had is the thing that has changed quite significantly and that is new now at the end of the 20th century is this very interactive, very aggressive Fed, where they're trying to be preemptive. And the idea that policymakers can kind of smooth the cycle out. And so when they see the downturn coming, they went very aggressively, and we all know about how interest rates have gone down very, very low. And at the same time, there was a huge tax cut, a Herculean. I mean, this adds up to like literally a Herculean set of stimulus hitting the economy, all this money. And that's what kept the consumer going, when normally the consumer would have pulled back quite a bit more. And as a result, we've had a relatively mild recession. The price we're paying for it is everybody's carrying pretty heavy debt loads. Individuals and companies are all kind of loaded up, and we all are carrying around quite a bit of debt. So that is one of the kind of prices that we paid to have a, quote, relatively mild recession. Another thing that's happened here is because of globalization, because of this preemptive Fed, we've had very low inflation rates. And this has accelerated dramatically a shift in the way that people are employed in this country. And while I know the manufacturing sector has been getting smaller for decades, the pace of that shrinking accelerated incredibly in the recession and in the wake of the recession.
It's like 41, 42 consecutive months of shrinkage in employment.
Yeah, and this last jobs report, right? We've had a couple of jobs reports that have been positive, but then again, we see that manufacturing has not healed in terms of being able to create jobs, and we see weakness in the industry's ability to create jobs. It's not the main job driver. 8 out of 10 people work in services at this point. But still, millions of people lost jobs in manufacturing, and those are unlikely to come back. And here's where the cyclical perspective is also useful, because we can tell what isn't cyclical. You know, like if we know what a duck looks like when it isn't a duck, we know it isn't a duck. And this, what's going on with the manufacturing job weakness, is something that is not cyclical. We are seeing essentially all of this production be very much affected by capacity abroad, where people, because of lower wages, are simply able to produce things cheaper than we are.
I'm speaking with Lakshman Achuthan, who is the Managing Director and Director of Research at the Economic Cycles Research Institute, and co-author of the book Beating the Business Cycle, which is recently published by Doubleday. We've been talking a little bit about employment. That's another thing that's been very unusual at this cycle. The job losses themselves seem relatively mild in the recession, but the slowness to recover. Mm-hmm. It was almost 2 years before employment bottomed out after the official end of the recession. What happened, and is that period now behind us?
I really don't think it is behind us. I think, if it had been a, quote, normal cycle and you had 8% GDP growth, you would have had, you know, 400,000 or 500,000 jobs created a month. That's what kind of normal would have been. If you were growing 8% GDP, more recently we're at like 4% or 5% GDP, you'd have much higher job growth than we have today. What's happening, I'm being overly simplistic, but what's happening is that manufacturing has sprung a huge leak. And you see when you look inside the jobs reports that the real weakness has been job losses in manufacturing, and they've been somewhat covered up by job growth in the service sector. And again, I'm being a little simplistic here, but the basic reason is that a service has to be produced or provided on site. It's not something that's easily imported from somewhere else. Whereas,
despite all the attention paid to offshoring,
that's just a fraction. I mean, that's more. I think that's much more hype than actual reality when we get down to counting jobs. But things, you know, like a cell phone or a shoe or a shirt or a car, all of these things can be produced somewhere else and brought here, and we really don't, notice a difference, so to speak. And as a result, we have been living through no less than a structural change, a permanent structural change in employment that is focused in the manufacturing sector. And it would be just wrong to think that that is going to recover at some point and become normal again. And I think that, you know, certainly many people on Wall Street and a lot of other professionals and experts kind of looked at the last few months where we had a rebound in jobs as kind of like this big sigh of relief that, hey, things are back to normal. And I'm afraid what's happening is just that a rising tide lifts all boats, right? But some of these boats have leaks, and we have the manufacturing sector has a leak, and it hasn't stopped. It's not going away simply because we're in a recovery.
And another thing that's been unusual about this whole recession recovery period is, we had a very sharp drop in corporate profitability from 97 through the middle of 01, and then a very sharp recovery. And even though employment is basically flat over the last 3 years, profits are up. I haven't looked at it. Well, it was something like 75% when I looked last. What's going on there? Is all the gains of growth going to corporate profits and people at the top of the income distribution?
Well, a good hunk of it is. The investors and the line workers aren't necessarily getting it. It's typical that there's a little bit of a lag in terms of wages, and we've just started to see some increase in income growth, which is kind of the lagged reaction to that sharp increase in corporate profits. But I'm afraid that it's unlikely to be on par with the rise that we saw in corporate profits. And also, more recently, now we're talking about the very current outlook, we're seeing those the pace of growth in corporate profits drop off because the economy now, after surging pretty much in the wake of that earlier stimulus, is now starting to ease off and throttle back a bit. And it took a Herculean effort of stimulus to get us 8% GDP growth, which gave us a few months of 200,000 or 300,000 job growth. So, I mean, if you do the math, there was a lot of money spent to get those 200,000 or 300,000 jobs.
A lot of heavy lifting, but not much vertical movement.
Yeah, so it's really out of kilter where you get this really strong GDP and this really relatively muted job creation. And, you know, it has to be. It's a non-cyclical event. It's this structural change, this globalization. It's the double-edged sword because, on the one hand, I think all of us enjoy lower prices for cars or shirts or TVs or whatnot, right? But the price you're paying is that you're competing with labor abroad right now very aggressively. And, they're very intent and very hungry to kind of get a piece of the pie, so to speak. And so we've got some very strong competition there.
I'm sitting here looking at a chart of the weekly leading index at your group, the Economic Cycle Research Institute, puts out, and it's still positive, but it's really come down quite a bit. We had like a 9% annual growth rate in the early part. Well, this is as recently as April, and now we're down to a 2% annual growth rate.
Yeah.
As I said at the top of the hour, reviewing some of the recent releases, we saw weakness in employment, surprise weakness in retail sales, auto sales disappointing.
Yep.
Is something happening, or is this just a little bump in the road?
Something's happening. I'm afraid. Something is happening here. You are very clearly going to have a deceleration of growth in this economy. It is you know, not speculation as far as I'm concerned. It's going to happen in the second half of this year, probably a little bit more towards the fourth quarter. But we've had this economy running above trend, and what I mean is there's a long-term, if you look over like 10 or 20 years, there's long-term trend growth of somewhere in the neighborhood of 3%, depending on how you measure it. And we've been growing at 4 or 5% for more than a few quarters now, and what's happening is that is behind us now. That was why we had record profits, this sharp recovery in profits over the last couple of quarters. That's history. That's gone. Now we're starting to decelerate. So we're going from 4 or 5% growth down closer to 3% growth so far. If the index continues to fall, then we would like start looking for what we call subpar growth, below trend growth. In order for us to forecast a recession, we'd have to see a much more serious downturn than we've seen so far. But I think people, if you have an opportunity to make hay in terms of your job or in terms of something that you're doing right now, I would jump on it right now and make that hay. Because right now, what we're talking about is these are leading indicators, so they lead the economy by a couple of quarters. It's not the economy itself. The economy itself right now today is still hanging in there. And we may be seeing just the front edge of some of this anecdotal evidence of the slowing that is going to become more evident when we see the jobs numbers a little weaker or the sales numbers a little weaker. Or also, if you look at what companies are saying, they're starting to warn a little bit and say maybe we're not going to meet our expectations.
And, of course, that wouldn't be very good news for the job market if we had a slower economic
growth. It doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't mean jobs will collapse and go negative or anything, but it certainly doesn't mean that they're likely to shoot forward.
And, of course, the first year of a presidential term is usually not a good economic time. So the best time may be behind us. I don't know. We're just about out of time, so I have to bring it to a close. Thanks for joining us, Lakshman Achuthan, who is the Managing Director and Director of Research at the Economic Cycles Research Institute, which is on the web at ECRI.com.
A long time ago we were ECRI. Now we're BusinessCycle.com.
BusinessCycle.com.
Thank you.
And also a co-author of the book Beating the Business Cycle, recently published by Doubleday. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll be back after a little break to speak with Norman Kelly.
Tell me the truth. How do you feel? Like you're rolling so fast that you're spinning your wheels. Don't feel too bad. You're not all alone. You're all trying to get along.
Hey, this is Bernie Ledden. You're listening to WBAI, listener supported radio in New York City.
And we're back behind the news of the program. My name is Doug Henwood. And again, that author was Lakshman Achuthan, who is the co-author with his colleague Anirvan Banerjee of the Economic Cycles Research Institute. The book is called Beating the Business Cycle, How to Predict and Profit from Turning Points in the Economy. And if you ever wondered what all those business cycle indicators and everything meant, this is the book to find out. And now we're joined by another author of a very different sort, Norman Kelly, who is something of an alumnus of his airways. And the book is called The Head Negro in Charge Syndrome, The Dead End of Black Politics, A Controversial Critique of Black Politics and Intellectual Leadership in America. Welcome to Behind the News.
Thank you for having me.
So, The Head Negro in Charge, evocative phrase. Who is it? What's that
Who
mean?
Is the head Negro?
Well, what is that? What is the phrase referring to?
I'm just basically using it to mean this is a sort of type of leadership which is self-appointed and symbolic, that there's not much real organizing or intellectual heft or political weight going on.
And on the cover, we have pictures in sort of descending in size of Martin Luther King, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, Malcolm X, and Cornel West.
Well, King, I do not consider a HNIC. I consider him probably the best effective leader that black folks ever had. But after him, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, in Farrakhan. I consider them post-civil rights HNICs, and I consider Cornel West a hit, Negro intellectual.
I'm sorry, that meant that was Farrakhan, that's not Malcolm X.
No.
Yes, I need new glasses. Now, if we go back to the 60s, a lot of people thought King was kind of a weak figure and kind of a compromiser and a sellout.
Well, it depends on what side of the fence you were on during that period. When I was young, I would have thought that also. But when you really go back and look at what he did, he and millions of others participated in bringing down segregation down south, and he helped bring into being two of the most important pieces of civil rights legislation, one of which we just celebrated the 40th anniversary of, and if I remember correctly, that's the Voting Accommodations Act of 1964, and also this is the 50th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. I consider King perhaps the best leader we ever had. Not that he was perfect. I was never into redemptive suffering, but he got the job done.
Yeah, and you say somewhere in the book that he was able to do in 10 years what the NAACP couldn't do in 50. What did you mean by that?
Well, a gentleman by the name of Robert C. Smith, who's a professor of political science at San Francisco State University, said this to me. I was asking him about something once before. He said, "Norm, you have to remember this. The NAACP had been around for almost 50 years, since the early part of the 20th century. And all they had basically achieved, in the mid-50s, they did achieve a Brown versus Board of Ed, but it's basically lobbying and protesting, things of that nature. What Professor Smith pointed out, that King came on the scene in 50 years, and by using protest politics and redemptive suffering and whatnot, and creative disturbance, as he would call it, he was able to bring down the walls of segregation within 10 years, from about 54 or 55 from the Montgomery bus boycott up until 65. That whole regime of apartheidness in America was pretty much done away with.
And what was the strategy that NAACP had followed that didn't work?
Well, it was basically, like I said before, just lobbying and going through the courts. There has been a tendency in black politics to depend on going through the courts. I mean, in case in point, 50 years now after the monumental Supreme Court decision of Brown versus Board of Ed, the schools are as segregated as they were before. As a matter of fact, Derek Bell, I think, has a new book out. I can't remember what it's called exactly. I think he had advocated or has said that perhaps what we should have done is taken the nation at its word, separate but equal, and push for getting better funding in separate schools. Now, that would have been considered heresy back then. As a matter of fact, someone like W.E.B. Du Bois even said things like that during the 1930s.
I think this is a lesson even for today, but the NAACP was sort of relied on elite connections, foundations, philanthropist funding, and litigation, whereas King...
King was out in the streets. I mean,
yeah,
he was pushing...
Organizing
people, talking about issues, and NAACP... See, I think the genius was of African-American politics of that era was two things, outside pressure and inside pressure. It's sort of like what the military has. The military just doesn't have an army and navy. It has an army, navy, marines, and air force. And each of those services has a specific, unique things to do. NAACP was good at insider politics. Martin Luther King and SCLC was good at outside pressure. SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, I mean, I think those folks were the United States Marine Corps of the Civil Rights Movement, because they were down south trying to help grow indigenous black leadership. And in a lot of ways, those people who were in SNCC suffered because of that, because they were constantly on the front lines in some of the most racist regimes down south. And I think what you have, I think you had an array of different types of civil rights organizations who had unique talents. CORE was one of the organizations that came into being in the late 40s that was very good at pushing things like, I think, the Rise for Reconciliation and things like that, and SNCC and SCLC played off of that. So I think you, back in the 50s and 60s, I think you had a much smarter array of leadership.
And how does Malcolm X figure into this?
Well, Malcolm X, I consider the great black psychologist, meaning that, now, this gets kind of complicated, because I consider King a much more effective activist of actually doing things and getting things done. And I consider Malcolm not so much of a good activist per se, because he was held in by the Nation of Islam. Malcolm was the best psychologist black folks ever had, in the sense that he was challenging African Americans to stop thinking or considering themselves being colored or Negro and think of themselves as being black people, and also not to get locked into this whole thing about civil rights per se, but of human rights. So I think, once again, you had this tension going on that was a lot healthier back then, because you're creating something. You're giving people different ways to look at the world and how to interpret it, rather than just having one way of looking at the world and one way of interacting with it.
I'm speaking with Norman Kelly, author of Head Negro in Charge Syndrome, The Dead End of Black Politics, which is just published by Nation Books, imprint of the Avalon Publishing Group.
Yeah. One handles the ideology, the other handles the money.
We all know who's the master of that relationship.
Oh, yes.
So what happened? I mean, we went from this incredibly vigorous and successful movement to what looks like quiescence and compromise sometime later. Where did it go wrong?
I think it collapsed about the mid-60s, 65, 66. Bayard Rustin had talked about we should go from protests to politics, meaning that we should go inside the system and work within a Democratic coalition, you know, church, labor, the usual suspects. And I think what happened was that, and this is an interesting thing, because African-American politics, by my research, has a tendency to stand down its activist wings. And I think you started to see that by them going into the system. You know, you also have to remember, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 made it possible for blacks to become elected officials. And even people like Frances Fox Piven, in a book about poor people's movement, she makes an argument how by the late 60s, early 70s, you started to see this increasing number of black elected officials going from activism into electoral politics. Nothing wrong with that per se. There's nothing wrong with that per se. However, African Americans stood down their activist wing. See, if you don't have an outside array or force to put pressure on the system or put pressure on your elected politicians, nothing happens. I think one of the biggest problems is that African Americans did not develop something like a Christian coalition. I mean, everything has been there to do that, but there has been either no political will or strategic thinking about that. Rush Ford, okay, in the 1980s, okay, Ronald Reagan gets elected, okay. It was quite clear that Ronald Reagan and the regime after was a more benign version of Reconstruction politics, meaning that blacks started to lose whatever they had gained during the 60s and 70s. If you really go back and look at that history, there was nothing done. There was no real organizing. What had happened was that black elected officials had forgotten or weren't interested in organizing the rank and file anymore. Jesse Jackson comes along in 83, runs for president, okay, runs for president in 84.
Because God told him to, right?
No. Because, there was this thing going on that they needed to have some sort of, like, protest, you know, candidacy to arouse the people. Okay. So he comes along in 88 again. He runs. Now, in 84 and in 88, he collected, like, millions of dollars. I don't have the figures immediately in front of me, but I heard he collected, like, maybe $11 million in 84 and $21 million in 88. He collected numbers and names. He had people who were willing to work for him. By 88 or 89, he stood down. Whatever the Rainbow Coalition could have possibly done, meaning being an outside apparatus, not a black party per se, because I don't think that works, but sort of like a pressure group and a way to organize people, a way to keep issues on the burner, a way to like keep your finger in the back of these people's backs, he didn't do that. So twice you have this tendency for African Americans to stand down their own organizations.
And then, of course, there's some other characters of the HNIC crowd that you talk about. So now his would-be successor is Al Sharpton. What's your thinking on him?
Well, I mean, you know, he's getting a reality TV show. So basically, as far as I'm concerned, this has just been one long audition. And I've written about this in 2003 in New York Press. And I just basically said he was HNIC number three. Number two was Farrakhan, and number one was Jesse Jackson. And it didn't surprise me that now he's talking about doing a reality TV show. In a nutshell, African-American politics has collapsed. Affected black politics has collapsed. All we have nowadays is pseudo-political mobilization. In 84 and 88, you can say those were real political mobilizations. However, when Jesse Jackson did nothing with them, it became pseudo-political mobilization. Farrakhan saw that you could run or be the second HNIC and not pay a political price for that. So in the Million Man March happened in 1995. That will be 10 years ago next year. He has done nothing with that. So it stood the reason that a protege of Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, would do the same thing.
And Sharpton, of course, had some smelly doings with the Republican functionaries. What was that all about?
Well, according to Wayne Barron in the Village Voice, he was getting money and technical assistance from Roger Stone. Roger Stone is a dirty trickster who's been around since one of the grandfathers of American politics, Richard Nixon, master politician in my book. Don't like his policy, but the man was a master politician. And he was giving, like I said before, technical assistance and money. Now, this is amazing because Sharpton said he was running to save the soul of the Democratic Party, yet at the same time, he's taking money and technical assistance from them. So you go and figure. Now, he will also, not only that, he will also get to speak before the Democratic National Convention. Go and figure.
Well, he's perceived to have a large following.
Well, according to the New York Times poll, I think when I counted it, and I hadn't seen this in months, but he got less than 30 delegates. Jesse Jackson, to remind you, had over 1,200 delegates in 1988. Once again, Jesse Jackson got 1,200 delegates. Al Sharpton got less than 30. So, you know, you go and figure.
You're also very critical of a bunch of intellectuals, mainly academics, Cornel West and Bell Hooks and people like that. What's your beef with them?
Well, I think they're basically a fraud. And this is what the argument I've been trying to make. Black conservative intellectuals are people who I do not agree with. However, they are better at being public intellectuals by talking about things that the public concern, crime, education, welfare, things of that nature. As a matter of fact, when you look at people like Lowry or Glenn Lowry or Thomas Sowell, there's a tendency for those people to have backgrounds in economics, law, education, sociology. If you look at people, the left of center, academics, public intellectuals, Gates, Henry Louis Gates, Cornel West, Michael Eric Dyson, they tend to have expertise in the soft sell, meaning philosophy, black cultural studies, black identity, English, and things of that nature. I think people like West have not really said much of any substance. I think West basically performs as an intellectual. I think he basically appeals to two classes of people. He appeals to the white left who want to see an engaged black intellectual, and he also appeals to like those of us in the black community who feel that we want to have a new version of W.B. Du Bois. But when you really go through what he says, he doesn't say anything of any real substance. I consider West and most of these people on the left market intellectuals. I also consider those people on the right market intellectuals. I think the black intellectual class that has come into being in the past 40 years, as I say in my book, are the most useless Negroes that black people have ever produced, particularly when you think of people like Oliver Cromwell Cox, E. Franklin Frazier, Rayford Logan, and the granddaddy of them all, with all his warts and all, W.B. Du Bois. And Du Bois was talking about some of these issues of how black America 100 years ago was very socially disorganized. It got better, but black people are now disorganized, and we don't even talk about this anymore.
I can't say that. White America is producing very many stunning intellectuals either, it doesn't seem.
No, but intellectuals in American society don't matter. That's, unfortunately, intellectuals, if you read today's New York Times article about how Americans don't even read, intellectuals do not matter in this society. Americans are a visceral people. We're not a stupid people, but the intellect takes a back seat. And I think this is why how people like West get over, that he gives people the superficiality of being intellectually engaged, but he really doesn't say anything. You read some of his books. He hasn't done any work, serious intellectual work, in 20 years. And other people who are some of his teachers and his students know this, but they will not say this.
But he's very good at performing the preacher role.
Well, he's basically, To a certain degree, yeah, he is a preacher, basically more so than an intellectual. Look, to me, a real intellectual was somebody like the late Edward Said, who I dedicated the book to, because Said would make you think. And not only that, Said took risks. West doesn't take any risks. West basically almost takes in $2 million a year from his works, speech, going around. But basically, as far as the left-of-center intellectual building an intellectual apparatus, there are no think tanks. There are no real critical think tanks in Black America, except for the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. But there's no Black version of the Heritage. There's no Black version of the Cato. There's no Black version of the Manhattan Institute. There's no Black version of the American Enterprise Institute. There isn't. African America is almost brain dead.
Well, I think a good bit of the rest of America is, too. Why do you think that there aren't these think tanks? What's responsible for the vacuum?
I think people on the black intelligentsia had decided that there are more. You can have a better life being in academia and not upsetting the apple cart, basically. I mean, it doesn't really matter whether you're left, right, or center. And my beef is basically, you would expect people on the left to really try to help organize people and to try to help them think things through. I don't think they're interested in that. I think they're interested in performing. The right, though, has aligned, Black conservative intellectuals have aligned themselves with the conservative movement. And as you know, Doug, these people have money, and they're very serious about putting us all back into the 19th century. And they seemingly right now are doing a very good job at it.
Now, a lot of intellectuals and others look at hip-hop culture as somehow politically revolutionary. What do you think of that?
It has the potential, but I don't know about that. I'm very skeptical. I know there was a hip-hop convention. But see, I think hip-hop has been shunted into the mass marketing apparatus of American society. I mean, it's interesting. About 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, The Edge was nation-conscious rap. People like Public Enemy and Tribe Called Quest and things like that. In the last 10 years, it's all been the gangster stuff. Why? Because that sells. Why? Because young white Americans like that stuff. They don't want to hear about Malcolm X. They don't want to hear about Ella Baker. It has nothing to do with their lifestyle. Most of the rap that is very prevalent nowadays is the gangsters. Like, take last year, 50 Cent, brilliant stuff. This is some of the most antisocial stuff I have ever listened to. I mean, production-wise, it was great, but it's some of the most antisocial stuff you will ever hear. Shooting this, nigga this, bitch that. I mean, come on. But it sells. And in the marketplace of America, what sells? It's like when Andy Warhol once said, buying is more American than thinking. And he would know that.
Yes, he was a wise man in his in his simple aphorisms. Well, I should say I'm speaking with Norman Kelly, who is the author of The Head Negro in Charge Syndrome, The Dead End of Black Politics, just published by Nation Books. And we just got another 3 or so minutes left. As we always do in the last 3 minutes, what is to be done? What's the way out of this impasse?
I'm very pessimistic. I'll be honest with you. I don't think anything's going to happen. I would think that if something is going to happen, I think we have to go back to basic organizing, go back to freedom schools. I also think that African Americans have to really start thinking about wealth creation of some sort. But I'm very pessimistic about it because nobody's saying anything. We don't even have an intellectual cultural apparatus network anymore where, you know, all our magazines of the 60s are gone. Black, I heard that Essence was sold to Time Warner. I mean, like, if you don't have venues to talk about issues, then things will not be examined or debated and discussed and acted upon. Right now, it looks pretty bleak.
You talk about the importance of, strategic non-voting, and threatening the Democrats with at least some withdrawal of those millions of votes that are the only thing that can propel them into office.
Well, have you seen that movie by Michael Moore called Fahrenheit 9/11?
I sure have.
Well, you know, there's a scene where several Black representatives went up into the Senate when the votes are being counted. If they got one senator to sign onto the petition to talk about that, to stop it, they would have stopped and recounted the vote and did an investigation. Now, one Democratic senator, which means Kerry and Edwards, nobody signed up. So ask yourself this. Why is it that African Americans are consistently expected to vote Democratic yet they will not even protect your most basic thing, your right to vote. The only difference between the Democrats and Republicans are this. The Republicans will stab you up front, and the Democrats will stab you in the back.
So what's strategic non-voting?
Well, strategic non-voting is basically perhaps looking at several states where blacks make a majority of the voting population or a critical mass of the voting population. And perhaps, you know, just basically in a nutshell, throwing an election as a means to teach the Democrats that we are not to be toyed with. Now, it's something that apathetic non-voters can't do. You have to be a voting person to do it. It's basically holding back your vote as a means to, like, punish those who have neglected you. And it's something you have to do tactically and strategically and not every time. But I don't think African Americans are respected politically in this country. And I think in order to be respected, sometimes it's better to be feared than loved.
All right. Well, thank you. I've been speaking with Norman Kelly, who is the author of The Head Negro in Charge Syndrome, The Dead End of Black Politics, recently published by Nation Books, an imprint of Avalon Publishing. And you brought along a piece of music you wanted me to play, so could you introduce it for us?
Well, it's from a little volume called Music for Music Lovers, and the title is called When It Comes, and it's sort of like my theme song. Listen to the lyrics, and the lyrics come in and out, by John Newbegin.
All right, let's listen to that. And this is Doug Henwood. That's it for Behind the News. I'll be back next week. Stay tuned for the news. And let's go out with When It Comes, John Newbegin of Vice Lounge.
Oh, yeah.
When it comes. When it comes. Material. When it comes, when it comes, I won't even notice. When it comes,
and I forgot to announce, Norman will be appearing. Is this tonight? 6:30 p.m. in Fort Greene, the Circle of Art, 4W Circle of Art and Enterprise. That's 704 Fulton Street in Fort Greene. That's between South Oxford and Portland. Again, at 6:30 p.m. this evening in Fort Greene, 704 Fulton between Oxford and Portland. Tonight, 6:30 p.m. Go see Norman Kelly. Let's finish up with John Newbegin.
Material is copyright.